We're going from the seedy back alleys of Center City in Bad Nights Criminal to the open plains of the Old West and the tight, narrow alleyways of New York in Pulp. That's right, we're visiting heavy hitters Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips's two picks of my own for this week's episode of our creator deep dive into Ed Brubaker. We're doing Criminals, Bad Night, and Pulp. I am Chaz Sticky Finger Simons, and I'm joined by my compatriots, and you all better keep this on the down low, because we're criminals, so don't give us away.
Michael Poet Heretic.
I'm Blake the Beast Morgan.
And I'm Synesthetic, a.k.a. Jack.
All right, we got all our criminal alii out of the way. So we're jumping in. We're going to start off with a very bad night for one particular man.
I'm going to bring something up before we get into this lovely little comic. If you have the deluxe edition, they've removed the colorist's name from anywhere in the comic book. Because this is, yes, before Jacob Phillips, which I find hilarious.
Man, could you imagine that she was their go-to color? She had a really good thing going, and to lose that so you can cup Ethan Van Sciver's balls, like, you're a moron.
I think it was her QAnon stuff too, which...
Oh, I didn't know. I just knew she was. I just knew she was a gator.
And a QAnon.
Yeah, that's a pretty bad bridge to burn for sure.
Which sucks because like Velvet was so beautiful. Like that work she did in Velvet was so good. Like she's talented.
I mean, you gotta salt the whole earth, beautiful. Right? That's what Hannibal said. You just gotta just kill it all because you're never coming back. So
I mean, the lights and the shade and how so much of it is just set during night, as it's called Bad Night. There's barely any daylight scenes.
I gotta say, Bad Night as well. Yeah, it really portrays the depth of color found in the dingiest parts of our towns.
I think it's based off of San Francisco only because of geographical locations around it, but.
Yeah, this is it's an excellent series overall. Let's just lay it out, I think, first. Criminal is a pretty long-running anthology series that is set in Center City. It's a fictional urban city. So basically just picture any dingy back alley from any cool crime or noir movie you've ever seen.
And in Wrong Place, Wrong Time, and Ed Brubaker has openly stated he lives in Northern California, they clearly go to Grass Valley or Mendocino County, which is like... a not far drive, too far of a drive from San Francisco. So, I mean, they're all fictionalized towns in California, but...
I could see where it's pulled a lot of inference from San Francisco, because I feel like San Francisco was sort of the scene of a lot of sort of key noirs that I want to say Brubaker pulls from. Sort of that 70s, 80s sort of, or I guess 60s, 70s renaissance of noir films, really. Taking them out of... the night into the day.
Definitely. That's where everything occurs. There's a main family named the Lawless family, and basically every other character kind of surrounds those characters. And our main character in this is a cartoonist named Jacob, who grew up with both Tracy Lawless and Ricky Lawless. Yeah.
Ricky and Tracy Lawless. Yeah. He's also an associate. If you've been reading the book from the beginning, Jack, actually, our editor, read all sorts of volumes getting caught up on this.
It's all connected.
Unintentionally, but...
worth it.
Exactly, because in Coward...
Glad I did.
Yeah, I was going to say in Coward, you actually get to see Jake, our main character in Bad Night, as he makes an ID, a fake ID for Leo. I think he does the same.
I really like the fact that they all are interconnected, even though they're completely different stories.
Yeah.
There's like a slight connection.
Everybody's in each other's orbit.
Criminal world.
Yeah.
That's
it's as connected as that Tom King thing, that statement this week, except much more directly connected.
Well, yeah, that Tom King news was crazy. Look, whoa.
That's how blown away you were.
So I would say, Chaz, I know you picked this, that Bad Night is probably, until the most recent run of Criminal, would probably be my favorite.
Yeah, It's arguably been my
criminal
my
story
as well.
With The Last of the Innocent.
I loved the femme fatale.
Yeah, Iris.
She was amazing.
I love The Last of the Innocent from this run as well. That fucked up Archie.
Yeah, that was a really good going in without any expectation of it taking that hard left into Archie parody or Archie satire was like, and whoa,
Archie
yes,
satire,
please.
Archie getting Jughead murdered. Yeah, just
really. Well, he knew too much.
He knew too much. But the main story outlets of this is Jacob Kurtz, who is the cartoonist. He draws a comic strip called Frank Kafka PI. And he draws this because if you've read other criminals, Sebastian Hyde was once the criminal, basically mafioso type of the town, the Corleone of the town. And he was married to his daughter, and the daughter died in a mysterious car accident, but no one knew what happened to her for a while, and Jacob got blamed for it, and he got crippled by Hyde's men, and they found out she died in a car crash, and he basically got set up for life with this comic strip. That's the opening layer of our story, and it actually starts with the crack house burning, which is our first introduction, and Jacob kind of saying he's glad this crack house is on fire. And he's kind of an insecure guy that sometimes has his comic.
So you know he's a little scummy.
Yeah, not too scummy at first. He seems kind of insecure and nerdy. He does have his PI Frank Kafka pop in once in a while. And he's just kind of desperate. And he runs in.
I love that she's a redhead. Has to be a redhead, right? Oh. I mean,
then in the very beginning, he runs into a redhead named Iris that causes him all sorts of trouble.
Always.
The titular.
Yeah.
It's symbolic, too. Yeah. That's where she's all the trouble comes character. From. It's from red. You got the burning crack house. You got the red-haired femme fatale.
I'm a redhead. What are you trying to say about me?
I'm saying you attract trouble like a moth to the flame.
That's actually not too inaccurate. But I really liked, stepping back just a second, I really liked Kafka, the imaginary PI, talking to our main protagonist, and it really reminded me of Elvis, I guess, the Elvis character in True Romance, and how he'd, like, feed ideas to the main protagonist there, except our
the
Kafka
Clarence
is a lot
Worley, yeah.
Clarence. I love Clarence. That's such a good movie. But how he's kind of feeding him these thoughts, but they're really his subconscious. Except Kafka's really looking out for his best interest.
Well, you're skipping ahead because I feel like a lot of it is a big twist near the third act of the book. I mean, yeah, he pops in a little bit. You know, he talks to him.
I've said too much.
You know, because we just read the Brubaker Catwoman run, like every time he pops into the panels, I always kept thinking it was Slam Bradley. And so the whole time, because he looks like Darwin Cook's Slam a little bit. And I was just like, I don't know. It was fun to think about. I'm weird, but it was cool.
Well, you could tell Brubaker drew a lot of inspiration from like noir pulps because he fucking nails it in that regard.
And Kafka himself, because the actual story is very Kafka-esque. And I think that's a lot of the foreshadowing to what we find out later in the story. So he gets in over his head with a redhead and this scumbag named Danny, which he used to be a counterfeiter and he hasn't had sex in years. He has sex with this sexy redhead. And he decides to brag about how he used to be a counterfeiter before he was a cartoonist, which is what he thinks drags him into this hellhole where he has to then counterfeit ID a Fett. But then everything spins out of control after that. Nothing is what it seems. And before we get too much into that, why does everyone else love this? I love this for the many twists, the fact that it feels like a Kafka-esque Maltese Falcon with an unreliable narrator and with some twists you don't see coming, and with like Jacob being so likable almost at first to then and not so much at the end. But what do you guys love about it? I know Chaz said this is one of his favorite picks, and he picked it for the podcast. So
yeah,
let's get some input.
This one, I feel like gets a little bit overshined in the Criminal anthology, right? Like in the whole series of Criminal, I don't feel like a lot of people appreciate how good this Bad Night is. And really, it's similar to me, like to put it in like cinematic terms, to the Safdie Brothers movie almost. Like this whole thing is just one bad experience on top of another, one bad decision, one chance to make a better choice and not somehow, and how that is so punishing. Almost karmically sometimes for this guy. But yeah, it's got a lot of great characters. Like Michael said, it's got just twists and turns, like left and right. It's insane. And the last few, only now after hearing some of what you guys have said, I see a bit more of that foreshadowing, a bit more of that like playfulness in the narrative. That's pretty rewarding. But it's soaked in great colors and just a good look from Phillips. Like everything is so spot on. This is one of my favorite arcs.
Mine as well.
Yeah, I am a huge Ed Brubaker fan, and I have been for a very long time. And this is where Ed shines, is this kind of writing, this kind of story, this kind of grit. He goes into these underbellies and these weird places, and he finds these weird characters, and they're shitty people. They really are, and they're very flawed, but he pulls them out of that in a sense. Like even the characters that you want to hate still have really cool moments. He invests you in these fictional lives of his characters. They almost become like real, and the stories never seem that outlandish, even though as we continue to talk about it, it does. Like there's the arc here, the character arc here is so insane. Like the changes that Jacob goes through in these four issues, like it's a lot. and it's just such a wild ride. And yeah, and when these two guys get together, like Ed, I read a lot of Ed Brubaker when he doesn't work with Sean Phillips, and it's good. But I mean, when these two guys get together to tell stories, man, like something really special happens. And this whole series of Criminal is great. And this is a very, very good portion of the run. And I think we can all agree that you should check out everything. But if you do want to get a little taste of it, this is not a bad place to start.
A really great thing he has out right now is Friday, which Marcos Martin, which is absolutely amazing and kind of a spin on Encyclopedia Brown. And that's amazing. And Panel Syndicate. And I feel like that might be his next strongest partner besides Sean Phillips, though I don't think Martin can draw and deliver as fast as as Sean Phillips and Jacob Phillips, who handles all the colors now. But that's also a really good story that's coming out right now in Panel Syndicate that I would recommend to anyone interested in these Brubaker books we're talking about.
Yeah, so going back to more to this story, I just really love how true to form it is to noir, but also that it's not following like a cop or a PI or what you typically expect. It's kind of just this dude who had a slight criminal past that got dragged in way over his head. And I don't want to give away any details just yet, but the most major twist, I think, you know, as I was reading, I was like, oh man, I think I know this. I think I know what's going on here. But you know, they made it so that it was still unpredictable.
Yeah, the way they build it up, because I mean, when he originally was accused of his wife, there is a detective Starr who constantly accused him of murdering his wife, knowing something was wrong about Jacob, and he put him in his comic strip called Officer Wrong. He's introduced in the beginning of the story, and he comes back in the end, because at first we're just stuck with Danny and Iris and Jake's, you know, kind of lustrous relationship with Iris. And then they end up basically, after They end up basically murdering Danny after they pick up $100,000 from Triads because Danny's acting like he is a federal agent. And then from then, the twists don't stop coming.
Yeah, if anybody reads this and is like, oh yeah, I figured that out by the second issue, like, you're full of horse shit and I don't want to talk to you. Because it is a ride, man. Like, page to page, panel to panel, it takes you to really dark and crazy, crazy, crazy places. And you don't see it coming. And then the end happens and you definitely don't see that. It's just, oh man, to be able to tell a story like these guys do, is to have that power, like, it'd be amazing.
Yeah, this was one of the most, like, frantic heist kind of scenes that I had seen as well. Because instead of getting the Danny Ocean, so Jacob being a counterfeiter, allegedly at least, confessing to Iris that he was a counterfeiter, almost in a way he admits in the book as bragging or trying to impress her with some sort of sordid criminal past, she robs him and now has roped him into this scheme that Michael said to get the $100,000 off the Triads. So what they're doing is they're having Jacob forge a FBI agent's ID, and that's pretty much all we know. That's what they want him for. That, so we only get one little, Jacob and us, only get that one little piece of the plan. Whereas normally, if he was a part of this big scheme, they would have laid out the whole shebang with some snazzy jazz. So by the time we get to the Steven Soderbergh, here's the reveal of our big heist, they're about to pull the big heist, which is just impersonate this FBI man and walk away with the money. But it, right before then, Iris is pushing Jacob.
As if it was so simple.
Right? Yeah, you just walk up and you flash a badge, they give you a briefcase, you walk away. So Iris is trying to convince Jacob to kill Danny, because that's what femme fatales do, right? That same, oh, my husband is beating
convince
me.
Convince you it's in your
is
best
doing
interest.
This. Yeah, yeah. Then they give you the gun. I can't do it, but you could, right? If you love me, you'll do it. And Jacob is not having any of it. It's wow, good for him. Until he realizes that he knows every step of this plan, and he knows everybody involved. There's no incentive to keep poor Jacob alive other than to drive them away. And then we get that.
And he was naive enough to believe that this smoking hot redhead was going to just run off to paradise
right.
with him.
With a crippled cartoonist with a terrible surrealist detective strip that most people, I don't think, appreciate, except for the, like,
it's only in publication,
I imagine it was
because,
like,
of
yeah. It ain't the Calvin and Hobbes of Center City. You know what I mean? Nobody is flipping open the paper hoping to see what Kafka's up to this week. They're just wanting to know who turned into the goddamn dog. That'll come up later.
And the and the other cops who use it to tease the detective.
Yeah. So it's an insane, we get a real wild Pulp Fiction inspired scene, I felt like, where all of a sudden this tension boils over and there's explosive gunfire, and now this not so good night has turned into the bad night, I think. Although you could take it a lot of ways, right? But this I think is where the bad night for Jake really starts. The first bad night is when he sleeps with Iris, because
that's not
that
like
really
a good
fucks
night
him along this whole path. Right. Good until it pulled him deeper into this underworld that he had seemingly, when he says I used to be a counterfeiter, had gotten out of, but I guess he's still, like, there. We see him do jobs. Jack, you saw him actually do two jobs, I want to say, the Leo job and the Tracy job.
Oh yeah.
So, like, yeah, so he's still doing stuff, but, like, it's nuts. Once this bad night really kicks off and we get to see new sides, I would say, to almost every character, the stress that's incurred pushes Jacob into a lot of Jake into a lot of weird places. And almost breaks him.
I gotta say, you guys know what the theme song of this has to be, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. Or
When she holds his penis hostage with a handgun?
He said...
We've all been there.
and then plays What's Going On, and they have graphic sex.
As the credits roll.
Minimalistic sex.
So there's one thing that I do want to just point out real fast. I know I just talked a lot, but the second issue, I thought, opened with a really great Charlie Brown quote that I feel like sums up Jacob's attitude almost throughout this whole night. Did y'all read that one? Did you see that? Was that in the trades that y'all read?
Yes, it's in mine, yeah.
Yeah, that sometimes I lie awake at night and I ask, why me? And then a voice answers, nothing personal. Your name just happened to come up. And I feel like that's Jacob's attitude throughout this whole thing. It's like, oh, fuck, I'm in it now. What do I do? Why is it happening to me?
When you were talking about how the first bad night was when she sleeps over, I actually think the bad night is the opening scene. Cause as we see later, you know, that fire, is his downfall. Yeah. I mean, that's his, everything he tries to do falls apart because of that fire.
It does have a lot of repercussions. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if the fire was, intended to start this spiral.
Oh, like a guilty conscience kind of thing.
Yeah, if it was to get him into that position, because, you know, it doesn't seem like these people really give a shit about a crack house.
Yeah. Let's, just real quick, what were your guys' over-under on Jacob having something to do with the disappearance and death of his wife? Were you on the Detective Star, you did it, you son of a bitch train? Or were you on the, I can't believe they think you did this, kid?
Pretty on the fence, honestly.
I didn't think he did it. I thought
he didn't
that
seem
it
capable
was,
of killing.
Exactly, yeah. Especially the more we read about him and the opportunities he had that he could have used murder to just, and you know, but I mean that all changes too. But yeah, he just, I don't think he did it. I think, well, we see what happens later as the story unfolds. But man, that whole heartbreaking tale had so much to do with the story and how you connect with Jacob. Like when that cop beats him with a phone book, and then they hire these people that cripple him for life, and all because like no one will believe him that he didn't kill this woman that he actually loved. Like I was like, that helped me connect to him, even though he is a loser and he is kind of shady and he's kind of weird and he doesn't, I don't know, like he's sort of spineless, and it's like really hard to connect with a spineless character sometimes. But because of that, like I guess it enabled me to like connect through pity.
Well, I really enjoyed the fact that he was like the last person that you'd expect in this situation.
Yeah. For me, it felt like
it added like a fresh angle to it rather than it being like a cop or a criminal. It's this guy who happened to have done some counterfeiting, you know?
For me, it had that like a history of violence feel. You remember where like everything's normal and then Vigo just like bam, 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 just takes some dudes out, and it was like, the fuck? How? You're just an American dad. You're just a thick dad. How did you knock out these two gangster men? So I felt like that was kind of the vibe that I was getting of like this. It's explored in later issues, which we'll maybe start sort of talking about more of this titular bad night. I use titular for exciting for that first good night.
Thriller.
This is going to get us the E. Do we have the E tag? Are we explicit?
I don't know if we have the tag, but we will.
Okay, yeah, that's probably going to, I was going to say, saying titular into my microphone all quiet is definitely going to get us that.
Goddamn right we fucking will.
The numerous F-bombs, nah. But
that's a context thing.
titular,
there we go.
Titular.
Yeah.
Titillating.
Fuck, I just lost all of that. Anyways.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
The five fucks we dropped right after asking about the explicit tag.
Yeah, I started thinking about titulars, I think. Titulars. Threw me off quite a lot. Boy, it's almost starting to be a bad night here.
So what the fuck were we talking about?
It's a great night with you fellas. Yeah. So I thought that there's sort of a hidden anger to Jacob is what I was saying. And it's expressed, I think, a little bit in his strip, the way that Kafka doesn't think. Whenever we get to experience the Frank Kafka strip, I think it informs a little bit of what Jacob's going through in that weird, like a very abstract way. So he just kind of is expressing himself through that, where he's in over his head. Things are out of his control. The only thing he can do is literally fight, literally like just strike out, shoot, do whatever. Right. So it's like an expression of that anger that I think also comes out in him. Early on in the book, he's an insomniac because of, you know, all comic people, I think, are insomniacs in some way. Readers, even, right? We got to stay up reading every issue. Got to stay up just finishing that one last section of the book so we know what happens. But he works on his strip until the wee hours of the night, tries to get 4 to 6 hours of sleep, I think it's described as, and sometimes has these blackouts if he stays up too late. He just waits for himself to exhaust. So we get a little Fight Club, I guess, ishness, I think, where maybe these blackouts aren't
Tyler Durden
sleeping. Yeah. So I guess to surmise a little more, after they successfully pull off this heist and we have that big explosive boil over in Jacob's car, Jacob and Iris have to make a big decision about what to do with the corpse in their front seat and with the money that they've just heisted off the Triad, who control a sizable interest, I imagine, in the area of town in which they reside.
Sucks he didn't have a fixer on retainer.
Yeah, right? He needs a little bit of action on the side to keep his butt covered.
Which he did have, we find out later, goes into that restaurant later with the body right. disposal people. So, I mean, he has connections. He just doesn't think to use them until...
Well, he's been out of the game.
Well, yeah. I guess he could have. That's true. And he's blatantly, like... He's sleep deprived. You know, he's too like us a moment ago. He's too distracted with tits. Like,
just can't think straight. I lost my whole point until I looked at my notes and was like, "Titular bad night." All right, guns go back.
Titular should be like a bad guy name, like the Riddler in Batman. Titular.
Yeah, that'd be pretty great.
He's like the female companion of Riddler.
That's the Shouju statue of a hot Riddler lady.
She's got like machine gun jubblies.
Yeah, it doesn't make any goddamn sense, and people pay like $90 or $120 for him.
Yeah,
a little bit of runway there as my joke died. Okay. On takeoff.
Got us back off track. Where were we?
So we're progressing through the bad night. Like any bad night, you have some drinks, you do a heist, then you do a little bit of casual body disposal.
I have a feeling the bad night could even be the night that Star thinks he's responsible for, because there's many bad nights. I think that could have been the bad night that started everything. So Officer Wrong, after Danny is killed, and they think they've burned the body and got everything, Officer Wrong, Detective Star, the person who has been trying to get Jacob and persecute him this whole time, comes to his house and it says they found 2 partial fingerprints on a dead FBI agent's badge, and it matched his father's gun. And then he knows that the gun that they used to kill Danny wasn't his father's gun. And then he gives his gun to the FBI agent. So this is where everything gets connected, is because he decided to put Detective Star in his comic strip as Officer Wrong. But the best part is we learn Iris, when Jacob is shot, has medical training, and she disappears on him. And that's the same time Officer Star comes back into his life, accusing him of being involved with killing an FBI agent. So he asks his friends at the Blue Diner, who has one creepy secret I love. He describes her and he says, "I think I've seen her somewhere before." So it ends up being a strip club where Iris used to strip as a nurse. And that immediately unsettles Jacob. And that's where we find out what?
Oh, that's, yeah, when he finds out that she was the actual, she was a nurse, and she was the one who was taking care of him when he was recovering through physical therapy and stuff.
And not only that, but she's taken Detective Star's temperature.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yes, and she, even creepier, to practice stripping, she would do it on her mentally comatose patients to get them to involuntarily ejaculate.
Whoa.
And do lap dances on
You took
them.
The thought a lot further than I did. I was just like, when she said captive audience, I was like, yeah, that's true.
They're captive.
No, where are they going to go?
He says, Detective Star says you did it for their involuntary bodily reactions. He says that.
I think, yeah,
it started with a boner.
That's pretty funny.
The boner circle was complete.
Yeah, the boner went down.
Sounds like a motorcycle.
How it started, how it's going.
So we find out that Iris...
established boner cycle now.
Iris is this woman who chooses terrible men, and she finds comfort in Detective Star because he's a police officer and he's gentle with her, which not even Jacob is. Jacob is very rough with her, even though she says he sees her. But Detective Star is very gentle with her, and it is Detective Star that has set up this whole thing to get revenge against Jacob. And he's involved with Iris, which then leads to a beginning of Frank Kafka becoming more and more in Jacob's back head, which then leads to our biggest Tyler Durden twist when he gets caught in Detective Star's house. And then big twist happens. What happens then, guys?
Frank takes the shot.
Frank takes the shot and kills Detective Star, but guess who's holding the gun? Jacob. Because literally, it is a Tyler Durden situation where Frank Kafka is a part of Jacob's psyche, and he's been having him do all sorts of stuff he doesn't remember. And from there, it kind of spirals out. After that, he gets help from the Blue Fly Diner, and because they love his comic strip, they help dispose of the detective's body because it's actually a chop shop where they turn human meat into dog food. Which is disgusting.
I don't think they were fans of his strip.
At least they don't turn it into human food.
No.
You don't.
I think he said, yeah, that's exactly what I thought it was. When he says, you are lucky I'm a fan of your strip. It's like, you're lucky that you have a strip and that Sebastian Hyde said, like, don't fuck with this guy anymore because we already fucked him up pretty bad. So I thought that was more it. I hope that they're fans because I feel like Kafka deserves some love, but when I read that scene, I was like, they fucking just tolerate this motherfucker big time. This insomniac who probably don't even have to pay for his coffee. You know what I mean? They're just gonna keep him happy.
So it all gets connected. There's some more twists, including after Jacob confronting Iris, where then something very different happens than what he thinks when he confronts Iris. And should we give away all the things that happened?
I mean, this came out a while ago. I think it's okay to spoil it.
Yeah.
We'll just say history repeats itself. And we get a witness Jacob's fall from grace in a high-speed SUV with somebody in the trunk.
She's in the front seat. She was originally in the trunk.
I forgot it didn't go full Stan. It almost went full Stan.
Man, that I forgot about that twist when things are just happening and he opens the I almost called him Slam Bradley again.
And Slam Bradley.
He's like, oh, you don't want him to see what's in the trunk. And he's like, what's in the trunk? And he opens the trunk and she's in it. And I was like, whoa. I was like, I forgot about that.
I want to say too, right after Frank shot him, Jacob says, Jesus Christ, Frank, you shot a cop, as he's holding the gun. Like, his break from reality is so intense that, like, right from that moment, that gunshot was literally the snap of this man's mind.
Yes. And then I love where he realizes that Frank came before the accident and before the crippling, that he's been
there. It's been Frank all along, baby.
Yeah, he's been pushing him, which got into an argument with his wife because he decided to cripple a teenage bully by running him over with the car. And he also torched
Strange.
A crack house.
A violent act by a violent man.
Yeah. And he also torched the crack house. And
everything's like vehicular manslaughter. It's such a huge theme in this. Like,
well, he also burns down the crack house, which there's a lot of people inside of it. So, I mean, multiple murders there.
Well, did they say that people died in it?
I don't recall that.
I think it was just a house.
There's no
it sounded like
a squatter
house, but Frank Kafka, thanks to Jacob's infamy and this ensuing accident and craziness, is more popular than ever, which means because of his inability to do anything and being all crippled again, somebody else is taking over.
Went from
leaving
squatter house to slaughterhouse real fast.
Leaving Jacob in traction alone. And what is the part with the new writer saying, I'm going to turn the dude into the security dog?
The guy turns into the security dog. He's trying to finish the last arc.
Oh, yeah.
So that complete Kafka transformation.
Into the dog. So basically, if you want a great noir book, that like the best way to describe it is like Maltese Falcon, but with a twist of Kafka and with Poloniak, it's perfect. And it's such a great highlight of these early criminal issues. And one of my favorite ever, I would say I have Wrong Place, Wrong Time, I love a lot of the most recent series, which maybe we'll come back and touch on one day. Big fan of Bad Weekend and Cruel Summer. They're both incredible arcs, especially if you're into the Lawless family, who is the family that kind of everything is connected through throughout this series, as Jacob was a childhood friend of Ricky Lawless, who young Jacob, plays a huge part of Cruel Summer.
If you want a gritty crime story with a twist at every turn, with great foreshadowing but unpredictability accompanying it, this is the book for you, for sure.
And great color and lighting, and I love that only one scene is in daylight, and not only just because it's called Bad Night, but it's soaked in darkness the entire story.
If you've ever had a woman come into your life off the dark and rainy streets of whatever city you guys live in, and just really run you through the ringer and get you involved in some crimes you didn't plan on committing, maybe you accidentally murdered for her, live vicariously through this book, because Ed knows how you feel.
He does. And just blame it on your split personality that's a comic strip you created.
Criminals like Jell-O. I've always got room for it.
I would love to talk about Last of the Innocents and Cruel Summer and Bad Weekend some other times. Well, we can always touch back on these creators, but this is, I think, a definitive criminal story, and I'm glad Chaz picked it. And from now, we're going to move to a stellar 60-page nonstop Western noir tale about monsters of all kinds, truth and reality. And Chaz, because I know we both love this book, but you're so pumped to talk about it, why don't you introduce Pulp?
All right, here we go. In my best 1930s, you're at the movies voice. News from the front. Hitler's on the march in Europe, while the boys at home sometimes support his fascism. Will justice prevail? Pulp magazines are the big hit right now. Westerns are flying off the stands. We yearn for the days of yesteryear and fire those six guns into these pulp novellas. So what we're doing is we're talking about this book set in 1939's New York that flashes back sometimes into the late 1800s, starring the Red River Kid, or the Red Rock Kid, Max Winters. He is a pulp writer of his own life adventures. He's serialized and publicized, I guess, or made way more famous anyways, his own life stories that he sells for cents on the dollar. But they are more popular than ever. leading him to some tough times in that industry. Is he going to rely on old habits? That's what this book will explore. Can cowboys really hang it up and ride off into the sunset? Are they destined to die in the thick of the action?
And a big part of it is the Red River Kid, which is his pulp stories he writes, is like a dramatic hero persona of who he actually was, because we find out pretty early on. So after he tries to save some, which is a lot of stuff, is he's definitely got a soft spot for racism and Jewish people, because in the beginning he's trying to defend some Hasidic Jews and he has a heart attack.
Well, wait, hold on. Let's not get there yet. He goes through a series of heartbreaks before that, too. His latest adventure has just been shot down by his editor. That's sad.
It is sad. He wants to have them go grow old and go and live on farms and kind of explore the later years like Herbert did with Conan.
So what I was telling these boys...
farmers don't sell shit.
...was I'm about 300 pages into Lonesome Dove. I've read it, started reading it over the last few days. And so it was a really great transition for me going into like this this cowboy story. It's like half cowboy, half 1930s World War II era. And so it was just really cool seeing that translated into the later years of a cowboy as well.
With the deep theme of monsters and of all kinds, with the Nazis being the monsters of the current day, and then representation of all the monsters of the Old West.
The enforcers and bandits.
Which much of the book, Max portrays himself as a hero until, you know, and he has a nice, sweet housekeeper that he made his wife named Rosa, who he's most worried about because of his heart condition.
Oh, she's a sweetheart. And
she is a sweetheart, which he's... then going to, because he gets robbed of the $120 he got paid for his last story, basically, after he, while having a heart attack.
He was trying to stand up for a Jewish man being assaulted at the train station and ended up having a heart attack. I believe it was his first. And even the doctor comments, you know, if you cut out alcohol and smokes, you might survive longer, but looks like you're already living on borrowed time with those scars on your back.
Yeah, it's a pretty hard line. It's a pretty, like, Western line for, like, a 30s doctor setting. I was like, whew, yeah. Where's the alcohol? I need to take a swig. That shit was hard.
Oh, totally. Grab a whiskey down at the saloon.
And so, like, I'm not, like, real big on Westerns, but, like, the movie Tombstone, like...
That movie's
really
amazing.
Has like a special place in my heart for how just awesome it is. And like, I like the idea of Western comics. I don't know of many of them. I really liked TKO's Seven Deadly Sins. I have Cullen Bunn's Six Gun. I've read a little bit of it and it's
tight.
Cool. But like,
you know, you got to read. Sorry. What? I don't want to. Oh no. I'll tell you later. Go ahead.
Okay. But so
I got a great recommendation.
But I want to read more Western comics, and this, it's more than a Western comic. It's not just like your spaghetti Western tale. Like, this is a multi-layered narrative because Ed Brubaker writes it, and he doesn't just write simple stories, and that's why we love him. But yeah, man, this thing, the whole motif of like the monsters and men and what happens to heroes and what happens to monsters as your life goes on. And how we see that like right away, where this old man tries to stand up for a Jew getting beat up in the subway, and what happens? He gets the shit kicked out of him. He gets all his money stolen, and he has the first of numerous heart attacks. And this
and nobody on the platform does anything for
nothing.
Him.
They just stand that, there and watch him.
Yeah, I thought it was also Might Makes Right was sort of the theme of this book too. That the victors write the story, right? So, like,
definitely.
Those two kids that beat up Max aren't going to be like, hell yeah, we whooped an old man's ass for $120 while we also teased this Jewish guy. They're going to be like, yeah, it was like six dudes, and we knocked them all out. And then we were like, don't come back because we hate minorities. And they were like, we won't because you guys whooped our ass so hard. Like, that's the story in Pulp 2, probably, of those two kids running off and being little pieces of shit because they're Nazis.
Yes, definitely. And then because of this, his money constraints and him promising a house to Rosa, who's really gave him his second life after everything he dealt with in the Old West. We also get pretty early on him being honest about he wasn't exactly a hero, and that Heck, his partner with the Red River Kids, name was actually Spike, and that they were more outlaws.
Lawful neutral,
but a little bit more outlaws. And so he decides to plan a heist at his elderly age to get this money from Rosa and gets sniffed out by, I think, my favorite collaboration in the book, by Jeremiah Goldman, a former Pinkerton agent that was on his trail to help him in a heist to steal what he's told originally to be Nazi gold. Which there's many twists with that as well. And I think their friendship is one of the highlights of the series.
Can I just stop to mention that when we do see the stories of his past, how beautiful it is. There's like this serene, almost watercolor, or not watercolor. There's this like serene painted background. It's
Jacob
like
Jacob Phillips is killing it. Yeah.
And then it's black and white over that, but with, he's always wearing a like blood red shirt, and that reminds me a lot of how beautiful it was in Schindler's List with the little girl walking in the red dress.
Yeah, the Jacob Phillips colors in this, especially in the flashbacks, are completely crushing it. He's doing a great job.
Definitely his father's son. Like, there's no doubt about it. Blood is fucking beautiful. Like,
it is. Yeah,
it's a cool book too, but it's very, very pretty.
It is. That reminds me so much of Cormac McCarthy, that series. I feel like there's a lot of symbolism here with monsters, because the Nazis, who obviously both Jeremiah and Max Winters have a problem with, which monsters are the themes in this, because we kind of know he was kind of a bad guy, and it's a short book, it's quick. So right after we're introduced to the Jeremiah, their friendship grows, even though Jeremiah used to hunt them, and then they're soon put into the heist, and things go wrong immediately, mostly because they're not really looking for what they said they were looking for.
But it's just as valuable.
As we find out in the end, it's very valuable. I really like the partnership. I like how it begins. Like, this he's an old man. His heart doesn't really work anymore. His body's not what it used to be. We don't even know when the last time he shot a gun was, right? Like, he used to be a hot shot. You know, he was a cowboy. He was riding horses and he could shoot you dead. And like, but he's an old man now and he has a totally different life, and he's a writer. When's the last time you even held a gun, and he's just gonna take down this armored car? Well, it's not really armored like we have now, but he's gonna rob this money car by himself, just walk up in broad daylight and do this.
Until Jeremiah stops him.
And Jeremiah shows up and he's like, "You're gonna die like right now. What are you doing?
You gotta do it at night. Sneak away into the shadows after." And he's like, "I'll keep that in mind for next time." Damn.
So something that was shocking to me was like, because this seems to be a pretty accurate thing that happened, but was the domestic Nazi rallies that were going on, and the counter protesters coming. And so, but then I thought about it, and that I was thinking about all like the Proud Boys and neo-Nazis and pro-Confederate people gathering at the Trump rallies.
This is
and
still happening
the BLM
today.
And Antifa were clashing with them. Yeah, it's pretty much still happening today, and people are getting hurt and shot and killed and arrested.
Yeah, Jack, I researched a little bit about that the first time I read this, because I was not aware of that. Like, seeing on the news right now, like, I'm 35, and like, I've never seen people wave fucking Nazi flags on the news in America in modern day, and I was like, what? Yeah,
until now.
And reading this book, like, I was like, oh my god, it's been happening forever. Like, you just can't escape hatred. Like, it is literally impossible.
You could go to secret Bund bars with Nazi flags all inside of it, just to go out there and hang out. And you know, all these people. And a good thing that Goldman brings up is how he was fired by Henry Ford, which Henry Ford had secret ties to Nazis as well as Walt Disney. But
so I think it's cool. They could have done that same exploration of that 30s sort of rise of fascism, or the not even a rise, but like the idea that it's there. They could explore in any of their other books. Like, they're all suited for the nature of that sort of underground movement, I guess. But I think it's particularly cool that they chose this one, their first Western, because I feel like the nature of modern Westerns, or like the neo-Westerns, right? Of like, even, I guess, spaghetti Westerns were like that. Let's not mythologize these characters, right? They're not perfect knights in not shining armor with their fucking six guns and whatever. Let's show them as the fucking, they're out to get their money, and maybe that leads them to do something good. Or maybe they have a moment where it's redeeming and they're cool, but they're scoundrels and they're bad guys, and they only get to say they're the good guys because they killed the other guy. So, like, I think modern Westerns explore those themes well. So this being exposed to that early history of, or that history of that.
The winners are the ones who
write the story. Write, so I thought that it's neat that it sort of pervades this book too.
And that's the that monster
critical lens of the America, you know?
As much as we try and bury our past and move forward from it, our country was built on slavery and racism. And even to this day, the Ku Klux Klan aren't considered a domestic terrorist organization, but Antifa and BLM are. And we really just need to move past that. And people have been trying since, you know, the 30s, before that.
I mean, it's all progress, Jack. Even. I mean, look at how we look at the OS now.
It is. It's just slow progress. And we can't ignore it's the root of that still exists
to this day. We're still slowly progressing. In 100 years, people look back at us, like me and Chaz said earlier, like as savage as the people in the Wild West.
Yeah.
Assuming we're going to be around for 100 years.
Yeah.
That's being generous. I mean, like,
fingers crossed, boys.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have to worry about it. I'm going to be dead, but like,
we're going to get that Patreon money soon, and then we'll get those cryo chambers like Walt. I mean, not like that. The other alleged rumor about Walt.
Allegedly.
Sure. Is it Walter? It's got to be for Walt, his brain, right? Walter Disney.
He has his brain cryogenically frozen, yes, to be revived.
Oh, I thought it was his whole body.
I heard the same thing about
MJ. I don't want that lengthy beanpole.
So during the heist where they're really just getting letters, he has his next heart attack, and Jeremiah doesn't let him down. He knows he wants a house for Rosa, so he shows up at his hospital bed, gets him his own house, a deed to a house, and $8,000. But he's also told by the doctor he has barely any time to live. He might not even make it up a flight of stairs. And to cut to like the monsters theme over and over again, because so much through this is Max talking about monsters and how they always exist and the land barons are monsters. He's still trying to make himself look like a hero. Is he then, after he gets this nice thing from, you know, Jeremiah, and he goes to visit him afterwards, the Nazi, what happens is he finds his friend dead, being carried out on a stretcher, and he supposedly fell downstairs, and he finds the original Nazi's younger sister, who gets beat by her brother on the stairs crying, and she tells Max what happens. And instead of Max already gave everything to Rosa that he got. And then there's this great part where he explains his original daughter and wife who died somehow in Mexico.
Influenza.
Influenza, you're correct. And how he used to tell her,
wash your hands.
Oh, man. Coronavirus parallels.
Exactly. That was the first coronavirus. How he used to tell his daughter the stories of the Red River Kid to kind of make her feel better instead of the actual truth. He would tell her these stories, and that's how his pulp story ideas came on. And then we're just going to spoil it. There's a great part where this elderly man stocks up with weapons, goes into the Boone Nazi bar, and basically says, the reason I talk about monsters is because monsters are the only ones that survive. I wasn't a hero, basically. That's why I'm alive. And he just blows this guy's head completely off with a shotgun.
Right off. Point blank in the face with a shotgun.
That was so satisfying.
So rewarding.
Jumping back earlier when we were talking about Jacob's coloring, I love how the Western flashback coloring goes into the modern scene when he walks into the bar.
We get those
gold reds and oranges. I was like, oh my god! I love when art helps tell the story. Something similar about that was Dracula, motherfucker. Erica Henderson's colors and art in that, man, like
beautiful.
The tone. Whew.
Well, that's just Jacob showing him that he's the Red Rock kid again. When he goes back in there at that time, he's no longer just Max Winters. He's going in as the Red Rock kid, the monster that survived the Wild West. And that's, as he says, only monsters survive. And of course, he's elderly. He's going to die anyway. It doesn't turn out well. And I just love that the last panel is just him sitting there, shot, bleeding, going, well, and that's how it all happened. It's such a great epitaph to just this incredible story that...
I feel like if I only had a few days left on this earth, blowing some woman beating Nazis' faces off with a shotgun and wouldn't be a bad way to go.
The fact that getting revenge from the man who used to hunt him down when he was an outlaw, the fact that their friendship builds to that.
I really loved just how his story ended with what you said. Anyhow, that's how it happened. Whereas the send-off that he gives the Red River kid is like that they might find themselves some wives down south, maybe buy some land, raise some cattle. If they play their hand right, they might even live to grow old, which so few gunslingers did.
And he did.
And his editor calls it shit. It's like, they don't want him riding off into the sunset. Have him go shoot some guys. And it's like, well, yeah, now his story's over. Fucking, he's not going to be able to tell it. So it's not going to sound like the way that he ended is.
But that is how he survived, is because he was a monster. Which is his
I know. Yeah. I'm saying, like, it's funny that his end is so poetic. The one that he writes for himself, right? The one that he writes for his Red River Kid character, which is the story he's telling himself, is so like poetic and like so few gunslingers live to this old age, which you would think at the end of this book, he would think like Rosa's got her house. She's going to ride off into the sunset and have her life like I never got to. So few of us do. Right.
Yeah.
But instead, he's just like, well, shit, I'm fucking dead. You know, like that's how it happened.
You know what's funny, but not actually funny, and it's really sad that happened in both of these books, was that both of these men, from Bad Night and from Pulp, you know, they're both storytellers, and they also have really intense stories of their own and very intense pasts. And both of these men have their stories taken away from them. You know, they hire the guy who writes cheaper. They can pay him a penny a word to write the new pulp Western stories. And then in the end of Bad Night, the new writer's like in the hospital room talking about his new ideas to this like incapacitated paraplegic
catatonic man.
Like, and it's just, I was just thinking about that. Like, wow, they just like on top of everything else, like their essence that they put on these pages, that their narrative, like someone just took it. It's not yours anymore.
That's Brubaker's little hint at doing independent and owning your characters.
Yeah. So comics will break your heart. I think I've heard that a couple times before.
Even though Kirby apparently never said it. But this, Chaz, I'm really glad
we all believe he did.
He did.
Right? It's a Bernstein Bears situation.
Yeah.
Berenstain. I know that the Berensteins wouldn't do too well in 1939 New York, according to this book.
What do they call that again?
The Mandela effect.
The whole Berenstain situation.
The Mandela effect.
Yeah.
Chaz, I'm really glad you picked Brubaker, and I'm really glad you picked these two stories, because as I said, they actually have a lot of similarities, because they're both about creators, and they both, you know, have a violent side we don't see originally. And Pulp is just so great for its Western monsters themes and just the Old West to the 39s, the two time settings, and Bad Night's so great as just your classical noir with crazier twists than you would expect. They just kind of epitomize. You should read all of Criminal. I would definitely recommend everyone reading all of Criminal. This is a great introduction to it. Definitely read Pulp. I'm excited to talk about Reckless at the end of this series because it's another pretty groovy book that I'm excited to talk about.
We got Gotham Central. I'm excited to read Gotham Central coming up too. That's
Gotham Central in 2 weeks. Yep, I'm super excited for that one.
And also for people that, if you guys are interested in what we've been talking about, you can buy the Criminal trades right now. But in the next month, March or April, they're reprinting the hardcover collection of there's two really nice deluxe hardcovers that have the whole original Criminal run, and they are being re-released in the next couple months. They will have new dust jackets that Sean did new art for, and they're beautiful. And so you can, you know, probably pre-order those at your LCS or pre-order them on Amazon, but you're going to want to buy those because, as we talked earlier before we were recording, Michael has the old really nice hardcover editions, and they're super expensive now, and they're hard to get. And so they're, now that Image owns everything.
Still under Marvel Icon at the time.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for those because I do believe the Volume 1 reprint comes out March or April. And I got that new art by Sean Phillips is so tasty. Like, oh, they're beautiful.
Final wrap-ups for this. They're both great stories. They truly kind of show that crime perfection that Brubaker's great at. They're both incredible. Read them, get those new deluxe editions when they come out, or go and buy the deluxe edition I have for like $180 to $200. I mean, if you don't want to wait a month, but you should definitely own them. Final wrap up the thoughts from the rest of you guys.
I love everything about Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. And this is a key example of just why this is one of, if not arguably the best creative teams in comics right now. Everything they do slays. They work so well together. They're good people. You know, they're just awesome. And this is a really cool Western comic. And if you're like me and you're kind of new to that genre of comic, it's really cool to dive into.
I got to give you that recommendation. You got to read Jonah Hex by Jimmy Palamati and Justin Gray.
Oh, I forgot about Jonah Hex.
And you also got to read
that shit is like incredible. Like, I want to figure out how we can get fuck any sort of different cut of a movie or whatever, but release the Jonah Hex, Palamati, and Gray omnibus, or two of them, or whatever it is, however many they would be, because I need to buy six of them to justify them.
That was before that. New 52, right? Because didn't they do a New 52 run together?
Yeah, that New 52 run, All-Star Western, was really good, and basically just a continuation of it, but with a different theme, essentially. And like, it was him based in Gotham.
And I
like,
gotta read it because Chaz keeps raving about it. And also,
it's on the DC Unlimited, I think.
Also, whatever, read Infinite, whatever the Lone Ranger by Mark Russell, which is also really good.
Yeah, that was also really good for a Western thing. But sorry, I realized I was like, oh man, I was going to tell him. And then I almost forgot. And I also wanted to tell all you listeners, all you outsiders out there, that you should check out that book. In addition to these two books, Pulp, for that really good genre tale mixed with that classic noir that Brubaker and Phillips are so good with, and Bad Night, another story about the stories we tell ourselves and others, and the consequences of reckless abandon, let's say. So yeah, they're both really good examples of why I think Brubaker and Phillips could somehow write and draw the phone book, I guess, and I would pay for it and probably be like,
I'd buy all the variants.
Look at this.
I really wish
it's so good.
I really wish that they'd turn the Criminal series into either a mini series or like a short series of movies.
They'd be great on Netflix.
They would be so good on the silver screen, man.
The closest you'll get to it that's not that is Too Old to Die Young. But
that show I can't.
I got it all blocked out.
I can't handle it.
Did you try to watch it?
Yeah. Yeah, fucking Nicholas Refn Whiting or whatever the fuck you pronounce his name. He's amazing if you give him an hour and a half I can't watch a fucking TV series of that.
I never finished that. I have like an episode or two left. Like the beautiful woman is about to like it seems like she's about to take over the whole cartel game and everything.
Oh yeah, the Jenna somebody.
And then you find out that the pretty boy like yeah.
Next week we're going to be diving back into White Noise with Deep Roots by Dan Waters, and we will have Graphic Vandalism himself, Johnny Alpha, joining us, which will be a Nerds from the Underground reunion with me, Chaz, and Johnny, which will be really cool. And then we do have a different kind of thing happening. It's not going to be an episode where we cover a book, but we're going to talk with Bob France and Kevin Cuff about all their books. In about 3 weeks, 2 weeks, we'll be recording with them. They're the creators of Metal Shark Bros, Ninja Nuns. They have a new book coming out called Spirit of 666. And we're going to get groovy with them and then also go on their podcast as well, which is called the Two Bros Podcast. And that's something exciting, and I'm excited about it. As always, I'm Poet Air. You can find me and Michael. You can find me on Twitter as PoetAir33. You could find the show on Twitter at Outside the Panels with a zero to start the word, and it's Outside the with a zero. You can find us on YouTube as Outside the Panels. You can find us on Tumblr as Outside the Panels. We are on Apple, iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and a bunch of other networks as well, and Spotify. Don't want to forget that one. And where can we find the rest of you guys?
You can saddle up and ride with me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Chaz Simons. Don't look for the sticky fingers part from the criminal intro. It's a bad criminal alias. It's not great because I'm not good at stealing and I just like sweets.
Yeah, so you can find me at sin_aesthetics with an X on Twitter or sin_aesthetic on Instagram, where I'm much more active. Or as Synesthetic on SoundCloud, because I got a bunch of bass music there that's pretty lit.
It's really good. If you're digging our intro and outro, you should go listen to the rest of Jack's music.
Yeah, I do a ton of audio work in all fields.
And then, of course, our Four Loko drinking co-hostess with the mostest. Where do we find you at, buddy?
Well, when it's high noon, you can find me on Instagram at BTMorgan85. And when the sun drops down over the mountains of yonder, you can find me on Twitter, BTMorgan85, where I'm tweeting too much. And
thought you were gonna say we could find you down at the saloon, down at the tavern,
yeah, right?
The local watering hole.
I gotta start letting my co-hosts write for me because everybody's better at this than I.
No way! I'm just like making some stuff up over here.
You can find me at the Blue Fly Diner in the back of the Blue Fly Diner. Just come find me. I'll be back
there.
We're
chopping people up and making dog food for the lost puppies of the world.
Man, now we got to chop you up. You said it to everybody.
God damn it,
oh, fuck, now I'm
infamous. You know too much.
Oh, I'm incriminating.
Anyhow, everyone, thank you for listening. We're excited. Still more announcements to come. Some we still can't make. Blake is buying a big truck.
Big ones.
And a big one. Are you going for the 1500 or 2500?
You know what? I heard they're doing a special 4200. I think I'm going to get that one.
Whoa.
Ooh. Ooh.
Dang.
Anyhow.
What about a 4200?
People be good to each other. Be good
heard
to yourself.
Heard of that E.
People be good to each other. Be good to yourselves. You know, put yourself in everyone's shoes, be empathetic, be loving, especially during this crazy and weird time that continues to last. And Chaz, as always,
turn the page and wash your hands.